You're listening to the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We have no truck with profanity here, but those of you of a more squeamish disposition may wish to exercise caution before tuning in. Hello, and welcome to Morbid Curiosities, a brand new show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid. I'm your host, George Colley.
And I'm your other host, Rosie Cole. We are the principals of Gimcrap Productions, a live theatre and performance company. Mm-hmm. And we research morbid topics that we both enjoy. And in our research, we just found so many interesting things that we just felt we had to share all this information with you.
Far more than we could put on stage in the space of a show.
Exactly.
So we've got a lot to share.
So today we will be opening the cabinet of death.
Woo, spooky death.
Very spooky. So the idea with this podcast is that we have a series of topics or cabinets. And inside those cabinets, we open them up and we run through an alphabet of all the curiously morbid things that we can find.
Yeah.
In there.
Exactly. So we're going to start this week by opening the cabinet of death. That was it opening. And drawing out the first
two. Is that what that was?
That's what the cabinet of death sounds like.
Wait, one more time. Oh, good.
Yeah. So we're going to start with A and B.
Oh, the beginning of the alphabet.
Yeah. We thought we might mess with it later and subvert the form, but I think people need to be eased into the format of the podcast. So let's start there. A, and I'm going to begin. A is for alkaline hydrolysis.
Who do what now?
Alkaline hydrolysis.
Say it again.
Pokemon Hydrolisk.
Oh, Pokemon.
Yeah,
cool.
Pokemon. It's a Pokemon StarCraft mashup. Alkaline hydrolysis. It's a process which, and prepare to have your mind blown here, it's a process which you are performing right now.
What?
I know. You're performing it, to be specific, in your small intestine.
Before you explain,
okay.
I would like to say that I don't feel like I'm doing it because I feel very alive. So I don't really understand what this has to do with death.
Let me just run through the stuff that everybody knows to begin with. Alkaline hydrolysis in organic chemistry usually refers to types of nucleophilic substitution reactions in which the attacking nucleophile is a hydroxide ion. In the alkaline hydrolysis of esters and amides, the hydroxide ion nucleophile attacks the carbonyl carbon in a nucleophilic acyl substitution reaction.
Stop
the mechanism is supported by isotope labeling experiments.
Not everyone.
For example, when ethyl propionate with an oxygen 18 labeled ethoxy group is treated with sodium hydroxide, NaOH. Yeah.
I don't think everyone knows this. I think only very specific people know all the words you've just said.
Okay. It's dissolving stuff in water.
Oh.
With the help of an alkaline.
Oh.
I'm going to start
alkaline. Alkaline is that alkali.
Mm-hmm.
And then hydrolysis. Hydro. I get it.
And lysis actually means to unbind. So
oh.
Essentially what the word means is the cleavage of chemical bonds by the addition of water. What if I told you, young lady, that I could save you about 25 years of wasted time?
Have you banned me from Facebook?
I've thought about it before in the past, believe me. It would take about 25 years for alkaline hydrolysis to deal with your body during decomposition. And alkaline hydrolysis as a death custom is going to do those 25 years of work in 3-4 hours.
That's crazy.
It is pretty crazy. It's a
That's
great
amazing.
Old time saver. Yeah, I know. Let me talk you through the history briefly.
So now we're going back in time.
Back in time. Yeah, to sum up there. So alkaline hydrolysis as a death custom is going to do in 3 hours what would happen to your body as it was enveloped underground by the moist earth in about 25 years. Ah, yes, that is a
so
soon-to-be regular feature on the show.
No.
When I say the M word and Rosie doesn't like it. It's going to be called George's Moist Corner.
No, that is not going to be a feature on the show, ever.
Yep. The process of alkaline hydrolysis, the first patent for it, actually takes us back to 1888.
That's relatively recent.
Relatively recent for a death custom. Alkaline hydrolysis as a death custom is very, very new.
By just custom, do you mean method of disposal?
A method of disposal, yeah. But let's deal with the history first. The original use for the patent was to break bones down into fertilizer and usable byproducts. And it was first patented as a procedure in the US by a man from Middlesex called Amos Herbert Hobson. Fast forward from there.
Why fast forward?
1990s.
Why fast forward?
We're going to do a bit of time travel there.
But what did he use it for then? Back in the...
Well, as I said, the original plan was to use it to break bones down into fertilizer and usable byproducts.
Cool. So what kind of bones? Human bones?
No, animal bones. Going back that far. Going back that far, in fact, and we'll cover this later in the cabinet. Cremation was still in its youth.
Oh, okay.
And there was still a grand old fight to get cremation accepted as an acceptable way to dispose of a body at the time. So alkaline hydrolysis as a death custom for an entire human body was a long way away.
Okay.
So from there, we're going to zoom forward 100 years. I'm going to zoom you forward to the 1990s, which is when we have the next sort of significant marker in the history of alkaline hydrolysis.
So people were just using it for breaking down some bones before?
Yeah, and using it very little.
100 years being like, hey, what are we going to do with these bones? Alkaline hydrolysis.
Yeah, for those 100 years, people would have to eat the bones. They'd have no option. They'd just have to eat bones.
They wouldn't be allowed to just throw them on a midden heap.
No, they had to be eaten. And people came up with very interesting different ways of getting rid of them. Grinding them down into edible products, and that's where we get Spam and Bounty
when
Bars.
When you say things like that on a podcast that's supposed to deal with actual facts, I think it makes it hard for our listeners to tell whether you're lying or not.
Okay, do I need a sort of goofy sound effect to demonstrate?
That was a big lie, that people were not forced to eat bones, and Spam and Bounty Bars are not made of ground up bones.
You can't prove that.
Yes, you can.
Well, what's proof though?
They legally have to list the ingredients.
Yeah, legally, that's schmeagly. Anyway, on to the 1990s, and I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Gordon Kay.
Bounty and Spam, please do not come after us for any money. We don't have any. We're not besmirching your good name. Bounty Bars are delicious.
So, Dr. Gordon Kay is someone I'd like to introduce you to, and the New York Low-Level Radioactive Waste Consortium. That particular low-level radioactive waste consortium, which I'm sure everyone recognises as their favourite, was looking for ways to dispose of, I don't want to get nasty here, but in inverted commas, researched animal corpses.
Oh no.
At the time in the early 90s, getting rid of a rabbit would cost about $150.
Oh, buddy.
Which to any millennials listening is about $8,500 in today's money.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So many sad things in that sentence.
A lot of dead bunnies.
So expensive, dead bunny.
Yeah, and I'm afraid...
More expensive to get rid of them than to keep them alive.
That's a good point, actually. They should have just kept them alive. Oh, but they've been researched, so they're all worn out.
Oh, that's not how bunnies work.
So Dr. Gordon Kay teamed up with a colleague from the consortium called Peter B. Weber, and they discussed, and they said that if those research animal corpses were liquid, they could go straight down the drain. They talked and talked, and they considered the idea of using alkali one day. And the following morning, Dr. Weber came into work with a pile of rat bone powder and said, "Is this what you were looking for?"
They were looking for liquid, and he was like, "Is this what you were looking for?" And they were like, "No, yeah. That's a powder."
And Kay looked at him and went, "I literally said liquid yesterday. What are you doing?" And Weber explained that...
he'd already poured that away.
Exactly, that the rest of the rat was in fact liquid.
And he didn't bring the liquid in to prove it.
No, it's not a very good anecdote.
God, scientists, why can't you make your work much more suitable for anecdotes?
Scientists are dumb. Global warming's not real. The two of them formed the doomed company, WR2. A patent was granted to them in 1994 for the process of turning rats, for example, into this liquid and powder. And over the next few years, they started rolling out units. They started being sold... worldwide. They were quite quickly picked up by the Mayo Clinic and the University of Florida, and by the mid to late 90s, 40 or 50 other facilities were using them for the disposal of human waste. They weren't being used for the disposal of entire human bodies yet. This wasn't entering into the funeral industry. Like I say, it's a very, very young, very new custom.
So they set up this company that was basically a company to turn things into goo and powder.
Well, to sell the machines which would do it. In 2006, a market emerged centred, I'm proud to say, on the UK for the use of these things as a greener and more satisfactory, some would say, equivalent to cremation as a way of disposing of a body. So that started in 2006 and has been steadily growing since. In 2007, the company that Kay and Weber formed, WR2, dissolved due to financial difficulties. The irony is as delicious as the rat bone powder. And around
Wait,
the same...
you think they snorted the rat bone powder?
I'm absolutely certain someone gave it a go.
Ew.
Anytime any white or brown powder has been produced in history, someone somewhere has tried snorting it to get a buzz.
Okay, I would say that's George's lying time, but actually I'm not sure that if that is lying
that
time.
That is not George's moist rubbish.
Oh,
that's...
God, why?
Oh, George's moist rubbish is a terrible name for a children's book. Around the same time that... around the same time that WR2 dissolved in 2007, Resumation Limited was founded. And that's another UK-based company specialising in offering alkaline hydrolysis as a form of human disposal. Resoma is a Greek-Latin derived word for rebirth of the human body. Other words for alkaline hydrolysis include biocremation, green cremation, and with good reason, water cremation, aquamation.
Oh my god, that sounds like one of Aquaman's powers.
I was just going to say, aquamation.
Aquamation
is a fourth level wizard spell.
you nerd.
I am super nerd. Aquamation and resumation. Alkaline hydrolysis as a practice. As I said, it puts the body through the 25-year process of water-based breaking down, which will happen to it after burial, puts it through that in just a few hours.
But how does it do that? Because that sounds amazing, but I'm not entirely sure what that looks like.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you,
yeah,
does it look like CERN?
If you take what CERN looks like in your imagination, so you've got the donut,
mm-hmm,
undo the donut, stretch mm-hmm it out into a line, mm-hmm, and then completely change it in dimension, size and proportions.
So nothing like CERN.
Nothing like CERN.
Nothing like CERN. Does it look like an MRI machine?
Okay, an MRI machine. I want you to imagine an MRI machine in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Throw it away, okay, walk out of the hospital, go
no
50 years into the past and find an iron lung.
Oh!
Okay.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is a stainless steel tube big enough to put a body into. And it's got a sort of rack suspended in the middle, kind of like how you would put a thingy in a toaster.
Yep.
You're going to sandwich the body in there, you're going to slide that in, close the lid. We are now going, and I'm sorry about
so
this.
So it's like an iron lung, except...
It's like an iron lung.
But with the whole body in,
the whole body's
not with
in
the head sticking out.
And none of the
because
pushing
if you...
thing.
Alkaline hydrolysis, the whole body except the head.
That would just be gruesome.
That would be disgusting.
Yeah, that would be gruesome.
Don't think about that. Don't. Oh my god, that would be horrible.
Stop thinking about what we just described.
So sorry.
So now that you're inside that machine, we're going to...
No, don't put me in there. I'm still alive.
Okay, well, we'll take you out then. And I guess that's it. But then we're going to find someone who is dead. We're going to put them in the machine. We're going to close the lid, tilt it so that it's almost vertical, and we are going to flood it with a mixture of 95% water. It'll tend to be about 92 gallons of water. And the other 5%, or 4 gallons, will be potassium hydroxide, sodium hydroxide, or a mixture of the two. So that's the alkaline. We are going to heat that mixture up to about 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and also inside that stainless steel tube, we're going to up the pressure quite a bit. By comparison, for... flame cremation.
Flamation.
Flame cremation. The temperature would be about 1600 to 1800 degrees. We're going to just pump this up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit and then up the pressure. The combination of those will destroy any pathogens in your body. It will destroy other toxins, fixatives like embalming agents, biological and chemical warfare agents will all be converted into biodegradable derivatives, and a lot of those things in the list that I just said are very problematic to incineration. Also problematic to incineration are things like artificial limbs, mercury fillings in your teeth, pacemakers, which would have to be surgically removed before you're put into a cremation retort. These things can all just be picked up from the tray after the rest of the body is gone. The rest of the body, when it's gone, will be essentially two different things. Some pure white bone ash, a lot like the results of cremation,
yep,
which will be almost as fine as flour, very, very fine ash. And, bear with me for this, a coffee-coloured liquid with a strong ammonia smell and the consistency of motor oil.
Gloopy.
Gloopy indeed. And that is, with some minor adjustments to pH level, which is acceptable to your local waste authority, safe to pour down the drain.
Well, this sounds great. I mean, it uses less energy.
Mm-hmm.
It uses
significantly less energy. On that point, fuel consumption in kilograms of carbon dioxide, the actual process of flame-based cremation in fuel and electrical consumption is going to be about 211 kilos of CO2. The total from a green cremation, aquamation, resumation, is about 32.
Wow.
Yeah. There are elements which you don't have to account for in flame cremation and which you do in green cremation.
This whole concept sounds really good. This process, I see very few downsides right now. I'm not quite sure why more people are not using it. There's very little fuel consumption. The waste products seem to be completely biosafe. It doesn't seem to produce as much carbon either. Like, there's very little pollutants. You don't have to mess with the body before putting it in the machine. Like, you don't have to take out people's pacemakers or their teeth or anything.
Speaking of the machine, it's a fairly compact stainless steel, mostly stainless steel machine. So the production of it is a lot less strenuous than making a cremation retort as well.
Well, this sounds great. What are the issues?
The funeral industry is one which is, and I'm sure we'll cover this much, much more as we go through the alphabet, the funeral industry is one which is very, very rooted in tradition. It took a long time for cremation to get off the ground, and it's taking a long time for alkaline hydrolysis as well. But it's difficult to get people on board with the idea.
Why?
For example, of pouring their bodily remains down the drain. If you presented most people with the idea of pouring a coffee-coloured liquid smelling strongly of ammonia and with the consistency of motor oil into a river, they might not love it. At the moment, it being a fledgling industry, it's more expensive to set up than a crematorium.
Okay, so I appreciate that, because anything new is going to be a bit more expensive until the technology
rolling out and being really mass-produced.
How much would it cost, for example, one of my loved ones to do this to my body after I'm gone? I were to die tomorrow.
Oh, crikey. Don't do that. I need you.
Okay.
For the podcast.
Okay, thanks.
At the moment, there is not a huge amount of difference between the cost of flame cremation and aquamation as it's being offered. Each will cost you something in the order of £1,000 to £1,500. For a service, bear in mind, for a service, including disposal.
Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the machines cost something in the region of $300,000.
But yeah, funerals are expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Really expensive.
Yeah, you have to do it, don't you?
Well, you could just put them in the shed.
Oh, that's something to look forward to.
My dad wants to be taxidermed. We'll talk about why you cannot taxidermy humans.
Yeah.
He wants to sit in the corner looking at everyone after he's gone.
I know he does. He's an interesting chap. We'll get to some more comparisons between flame cremation and aquamation when we get to covering cremation.
That's next episode!
Oh, don't give it away!
I'm sorry.
So there you have where we stand with alkaline hydrolysis. There's a little history of it, an explanation of it, and hopefully a few facts on why, as far as we're concerned at least, it's a good idea.
Yeah, it sounds like a really great eco-friendly alternative to cremation.
Cabinet of Death, A for alkaline hydrolysis. Now it's time for the direful digression.
Oh my god, you're going off topic again.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to the first episode here. We'd like to just take a moment in between letters here to ask you to please, if you're enjoying what you're hearing, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. Do you follow people on Snapchat?
I don't know how Snapchat
works. I'm in my
works.
30s. MySpace, Friendster, Bebo, Alta Vista, Angel Fire,
GeoCities.
DOS?
What G is trying to say is that if you want to follow us on Twitter, our handle is @JimCrackShows. If you want to follow us on Facebook, we are facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1. I think Instagram with JimCrackProductions.
Yeah, I think
we
that's right.
Don't have a MySpace or a Bebo or a Friendster or anything like that.
Wow, we are really failing at our online presence.
No, it's fine.
I've got to update my Twitter subscription.
If you want to get in on the conversation on Twitter and tell us some morbid facts, suggest topics,
we always want to talk about this stuff.
Quirky questions, you can use the hashtag MorbidCurioCast.
This is also going to be another regular feature. If you want to make suggestions on Twitter of topics related to, in this case, death, beginning with Q, X, or Z. That would be a fun game for you to play.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. I mean, we've got ideas.
We've got tons of ideas. We just want to whittle down the Q list, because yeah, it's 3 pages long at the moment.
Yeah, tons of things begin There's with Q, X, and Z.
Quick death, quiet death.
That's not...
Quiescent death.
We also make art about these topics, so if you'd like to see this information transformed...
Live art.
Yes, into artistic brilliance. We have an absolute ton of dates coming up this autumn, starting in the spookiest month, October. We start our residency at Live at Zedel, which is at Crazy Cox in Brasserie Zedel in beautiful London's Piccadilly.
That's a beautiful bar.
West End! What? Our first show is on Sunday, the 9th of October at 9 p.m. Later in the year, starting in November, there's also Moribund, which is our show that we actually made about death, which is where a lot of this information is in there, but part of this podcast was getting to share the information we didn't get into the show.
We started researching death and we filled up sort of 6 notebooks with information.
So we're going to give you some more information on that closer to the time. You?
Me? If you're desperate for more of me in particular, and you're only human, you can come visit the Apothecary Cabaret.
We love you, Apothecary! Shout out Apothecary!
Which I will be comparing October the 5th, which is a Wednesday.
That's volume 11.
Volume 11, yeah. At the basement of a place called Haunt in Stoke Newington.
Also London, England.
Also London, which is a really, really wonderful evening. Do come along and throw rotten fruit at me. One more thing for now. We'll be performing a brand new cabaret act together. The two of us at Cabaret Roulette, which is an awesome fixture on the London Cabaret calendar, at the wonderful Royal Vauxhall Tavern in
Vauxhall
on
the 12th of October.
Nearly didn't get it there.
No, I thought you meant like in Vauxhall on. I was like
the Thames,
a boat. Yeah, well, that's what I thought you meant.
Guys, if you like what we're doing, please, please tell your friends. Getting a new podcast started and popular is all about word of mouth. So if you like what we do, we would love your help in telling people. And when we very soon get ourselves onto iTunes, please, please rate and review. Yeah, so, any help you could give us in those regards would be terrific. And speaking of be...
Oh my God, did we just go on a segue. Huge tangent?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was the direful digression.
It was the direful digression. But speaking of be...
Yes, speaking of be...
What does be stand for?
Be... stands for Buried Alive. So premature burial, also known as live burial, burial alive, or vivisepulture.
Ooh, that's a good word.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
Is it sepulture? It's not sepulchre.
No, sepulture, like vulture, but sep at the beginning. Vivisepulture. Okay. One of the amazing things about this topic is that it seems to be this utterly primal, universal fear that humans have that dates back to some of the earliest reports in human history.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
You know who did write about being buried alive?
Cormac McCarthy.
Pliny the Elder.
Never heard of him.
You definitely have heard of Pliny the Elder.
Nope, I need education on Pliny the Elder.
You know about Pliny the Elder because we listened to an amazing podcast called Sawbones.
Sawbones.
Pliny the Elder wrote about it in Natural History, which was 77 CE.
77 CE?
Yeah. That's
1950-something years ago.
So Pliny the Elder wrote about being buried alive. Being buried alive is also a plot device in Shakespeare's play Pericles.
He really did cover every base, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He totally did, which is why he's possibly still so famous. The fear of being buried alive is known as taphophobia. So there are many accounts of premature burial. Fear of premature burial reached a fever pitch in possibly my favourite eras in history, which is the 18th and 19th centuries.
Okay, cool.
That something about that time period, about the mid-1700s, right the way through to the early 1900s, is utterly fascinating to me. And it's possibly because...
of Edgar Allan Poe.
Well, yes. But he was kind of like in the middle, and there was the Romantics, and there was the Enlightenment, and the... really cool stuff happened.
Okay, yeah. But I think we, as a society, at least in England, we generally got very good at both scaring each other and being scared.
Yeah, absolutely.
Around that time in history.
Absolutely. Yes, Edgar Allan Poe is absolutely full of stories of premature burial. He wrote a story called The Premature Burial, and it happens also in his famous short story, The Fall of the House of Usher.
Yep.
one of the reasons in that era it was so talked about was because of the cholera epidemics. The cholera outbreaks meant that people were burying people very rapidly in order to try and prevent the spread of the disease.
We got 30 seconds to get this body in the ground. Everybody grab a shovel.
Well, it was more like, this dead body is full of diseases, because that's how people thought diseases spread then. Dummies. So they'd be like, oh my God, put it in the ground now. Quickly, quickly. It's definitely dead. I super checked. And then everyone was like, what if they didn't check?
No, he was just napping.
What if they didn't check?
He's just having a cholera nap.
What if we didn't check enough? And therefore the fear of premature burial.
They should have watched our hit show Moribund. We would have set them right on that.
Yes. So one of the first of modern Europe's ever documented cases of premature burial was in 1674. And that was the case of Madame Blunden. She drank some poppy water to ease her pain one day.
Some poppy water.
And she overdid it, passed out, and never regained consciousness. Her husband was away on business, travelling, and said, please don't bury my wife until I get back.
Oh, grimy. How long was he away?
A while, because they buried her before he got back. Because she'd started to smell.
To smell? I would have guessed that.
Yep. They kind of insisted on burying her immediately because she was so pungent. She was buried in the grounds of the Chapel of the Holy Ghost, which was adjacent to a boys' school. And one day, two schoolboys playing near the grave to have heard the words, take me out my grave, and all the horrible noises coming from the grave.
Of course they did.
Well, so they ran and they got the schoolmaster. So the schoolmaster beat these two boys. However, the boys decided the next day to see whether they were just hallucinating it. So they went back and apparently heard these horrible noises again. So when it's got the schoolmaster...
It was a badger, wasn't it?
Doubt it.
It was a badger.
This all happened in Basingstoke, by the way.
Oh, they don't have badgers in Basingstoke.
Yeah, probably not. Anyway, they went to the schoolmaster again, and this time the schoolmaster apparently seemed to think, okay, they've come back, clearly not for another beating, they must be telling the truth, let's go get a church warden. So they went. He went to go find the church warden, which seemed to take quite a while. And in that time, a crowd gathered around the grave. Finally, they decided to exhume the grave, open the grave, and she appeared dead.
Yeah.
But her body was covered, to the horror of the bystanders, in what looked like self-inflicted bruises. So for a second time, she was pronounced dead, but most of the witnesses were of the impression that she had, in fact, been given a premature burial. That did nothing to stem the taphophobia that was beginning to take hold across the UK. 1895 seems to have been the absolute peak year for taphophobia. Several books were published that year about premature burial, and an article in The Spectator said, and I quote, burning, drowning, even the most hideous mutilation under a railway train is as nothing compared with burial alive.
I can get on board with that statement. Burial alive, I wake up in a box and I've got nothing to do.
Okay, I don't think that's why people were scared of it. There are a lot of accounts of being buried alive that year. One of the books that was published was by the Reverend Ousley, 1895. It was called Earth to Earth Burial. And that estimated that about 2,700 people were buried alive in the UK.
What was his sample?
Every year.
What was his sample data?
Have no idea. Genuinely have no idea. There was another book from two people who will be recurring figures in this amazing topic. An Englishman called William Tebb and an American colonel called Colonel Edward P. Vollum, who published the book Premature Burial and How It Can Be Prevented.
Edward P. Vollum.
Yes.
Good, solid name.
Yeah, it's pretty good. In this book, they listed 161 cases of premature burial in the UK, as well as 219 narrow escapes, 10 premature dissections, and 2 embalmings that commenced before consciousness unexpectedly returned to the body on the table. These two also founded a society for the prevention of premature burial. It was the London Society for the Prevention of Premature Burial. And that kind of dissolved through lack of interest in 1936. They both died pretty early on in its society lifetime.
And their legacy did not live on.
Well, they have other legacies. So William Tebb was quite a voracious anti-vaxxer. But yeah, he was super against the mandatory vaccination for smallpox, though if he'd succeeded, we'd still have smallpox.
Good work, man.
Yeah.
Well done, Tebby.
Good, bad work.
Luckily, the rest of the world prevailed and we have eliminated smallpox.
There was another person who wrote a book that year that was published, a man called Franz Hartmann, whose book was called Buried Alive, creatively. And that was in America. He enumerated over 700 cases of live burial.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, the veracity of his stories is dubious.
Dubious veracity is a recurring theme in...
In the 1800s?
In the 1800s in general, and in people relating stories of burial alive, it seems.
So Hartmann was an actual doctor, and he actually, in his book, told a brilliant story of a Frenchman who was given an incredibly lavish funeral, only to wake up and be presented with a bill for expenses for both the clergy and the undertakers for his lavish funeral. Which would kind of suck, really, wouldn't it?
What, on the spot?
I'm not sure. Like, how long would you leave it?
What, before you gave him the bill?
Yeah.
God,
oh, thank God, you're alive! Oh, this was very expensive. I mean, like...
I'm just going to pop back in the grave. Oh, no, too many francs. Back in the grave, I beg moi.
Despite the fact that Hartmann was an actual doctor, he was taken even less seriously than Tebb and Vollum, mainly because of his fervent belief in the occult and theosophy. Might have undermined him a tiny bit. So there you go. There are lots of accounts of live burial. And actually, if you Google accounts of premature burial, people will present accounts from these books as though they are fact, though they've never really been verified and seem to be like anecdotal accounts.
Imagine my shock.
Apart from the fact that people were burying people very quickly because of cholera, I'm sure the question that is burning upon your lips is... Why did people think being buried alive was so common?
Well, it's burning on my lips now. Why?
There are a lot of reasons for that. So one of them being that when people exhumed, signs of decomposition were often mistaken for bruises. The skin would discolour.
I'm going to guess that another thing is, because I've heard about this partly from the X-Files, that rigor mortis can set... your body into strange poses.
Yep.
Which can am I getting that right?
Yep, you are absolutely correct.
Yes.
Yep. So a lot of these accounts, again, if you Google it, you will get a lot of these stories of premature burial presented as like crack.com, actual live burials. Not a lot of it will say, oh, they opened her coffin and she was contorted in and her mouth was open in a horrific scream.
Yeah, that's rigor mortis.
Exactly.
Amazing. When... This is a irregular feature of the show. Mm-hmm. An irregular feature of the show where I guess something and I'm actually right about it.
Well, no.
George's moist insight.
Oh, God. That word is banned.
Just turned it into the forbidden fruit.
Yeah, rigor mortis. First of all, your jaw muscles can contract, giving your face a kind of like awful scream.
Sure.
Kind of look like Munch's, Edward Munch's painting, The Scream.
That's what that painting horrible. Sounds like, yeah.
Just think about that noise in your next look at it. And it can also contort limbs into sort of very strange positions as if people have been sort of like scratching. The other thing that could happen is people's fingers and limbs would be kind of like eaten away as if they'd been like scratching at the coffin. But this could really easily be explained by vermin that were underground because they only used to bury people about 3 feet deep. 6 feet is... I think new regulations in the last 100 years or so.
So but, the little vermin start off nibbling at the fingernails and...
Yeah, the fingers or bits of arms and legs and things and, yeah.
People were very impressionable back then because of Edgar Allan Poe almost entirely.
Well, one could say he just tapped into a zeitgeist.
I say he was the zeitgeist.
So a lot of people wanted to avoid being buried alive. And we still do. There were a lot of ways to avoid it.
I do.
You want to avoid being buried alive?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
I've got a way to avoid it.
How?
Die.
Actually die, yes. Yeah. That is a good way.
That's my hot tip.
It's very difficult to put in place things to avoid being buried alive because when you appear dead, I would assume it'd be very difficult to speak or alert people to the fact that you are in fact still alive. Because
sure. The moment you say hello, people cotton on to the fact that
you shouldn't go in the ground.
The old ticker's still ticking.
My first advice is either to be very, very alive or actually die.
Actively alive, you might
yes.
say.
Yes. back in the day, people had all kinds of amazing ways of avoiding being buried alive.
Again, I'm going to suggest dying.
Yeah, well...
Also, just whenever you think someone's dead, just put a bullet through their head.
Well, actually, you know what? You're not far wrong again.
Oh, come on.
No, so, first of all, Vollum, he was actually a member of the medical department of the US and recommended that all US soldiers be buried with chloroform in case they woke up and needed to kill themselves quickly to avoid the horror of being buried alive.
What a delight to find that in your kit.
So that was one recommendation he made.
What a delight.
A lot of people left instructions in their will for their doctor to make sure they were dead. Do you know the English MP, Edward Bulwer-Lytton?
I'm not really politics savvy. Ask me one about video games.
You should know him for his famous phrase, "It was a dark and stormy night."
Oh, he invented the cocktail.
Yes. Well, so he stipulated in his will that his heart should be punctured by his doctor before he was laid in the coffin. He didn't say how. He just said he wanted his heart punctured before he was put in the coffin. People were actually still instructing doctors to mutilate their corpses well into the early 1900s.
Mutilate their corpses? Tell me more.
Yeah. So, well, in 1915, an issue of the Times reported that a Miss Emily Harriet, a resident of Bayswater, issued £20, which is the equivalent of about £2,500.
Okay.
Pre-today's recession?
Post-Brexit?
Yeah, it's probably about the same post-Brexit. Probably £20 again. So she asked her doctor, Dr. Stanley Bousfield, on her death, if he wanted to get this money, that he would have to slit her throat from ear to ear.
Fun day.
To make sure she was super dead. And then a few years later,
yeah.
Miss Lucy Soulsby, who was a former headmistress of the famous Oxford High School for Girls, made a similar request in her will, and the wording was thus... "I desire that at my death the doctor shall cut my carotid artery, and if by some mistake this be omitted, I desire that my body be exhumed and this be done."
Wow, did it have to be done?
Well, she died in 1927,
yeah.
And there's no record of the doctor doing it or not doing it.
Well, we have to know if it was done or not, because if it wasn't, then we have to go there and do it now.
Let's just say it was then. That was one way of putting in a precaution to say that, you know, you wouldn't be buried alive because your doctor...
I think that's a pretty smart way to go about it.
Well, if I were a doctor and the person weren't actually dead and then I punctured their heart, that's a murder.
No, it's in the will.
Yeah, but it's still a murder.
No, it's not murder if someone tells you to do it.
That is not true.
Lawyers, if you know about this, tweet at us.
Tenuous legal defence. Please submit legal information to @JimCrackShows. So another thing that people used to do was build things called safety coffins.
Oh, this is where it gets fun. I know about
this. Yes. So safety coffins are coffins fitted with mechanisms to prevent premature burial or allow the occupant to signal that they have been buried alive from inside the coffin. So a huge number of them were patented during the 18th and 19th centuries. And actually variations on them are still available today if you're particularly freaked out. So for example, in 1798, a German priest called Pessler suggested that all coffins have a tube inserted in them from which a cord would run to the church bells. So if an individual had been buried alive, he could draw attention to himself by ringing the bells. Super impractical.
Yeah.
But that was the first concept of safety coffins with signalling systems. Other features would be things like an air tube to provide a fresh supply of air, a little window to let some light in. People would also be buried with keys in their pockets, one for their coffin and one for their tomb door. So they could get out.
Oh, I see. Right, if they were interred in a tomb.
Yeah.
Because if you woke up 3 or 6 feet underground with just a key, I'd be pretty annoyed.
Just stabbing it into the wood and leaving your coffin going, "Let me out."
Trying to Uma Thurman your way out of there.
Dr. Adolf Gutsmuth, this guy is one of my favourites, he was buried alive several times to demonstrate a safety coffin of his own design. And in 1822, he stayed underground for several hours, and this is the best bit, he even ate a meal.
In his coffin?
Of soup, bratwurst, marzipan, sauerkraut, spatzel, beer, and for dessert, a Prince Regent tort. Delivered to him through the coffin's feeding tube.
Sauerkraut through a tube? How many tubes were there?
I have no idea.
I feel like all of them going down together would be a bit gross.
Yeah. Wash the beer down with the sauerkraut followed by the whatever it was for pudding.
Yeah. The Germans were particularly pioneering, it would seem. There were issues with this, as I'm sure you can imagine. One of the main issues with these was the fact that the natural processes of decay often cause the body to move, swell, shift position, as we talked about. Yeah, lots of false alarms. So then the idea of the sort of periscope to look at the corpse was added up in 1868.
Not for the corpse to look up, just for people to look down?
Maybe for the corpse to look up, I don't know.
Were there any that you had to put a halfpenny in? Just get a little crank for a dynamo for a light down so you can light up and
what
have a
does the
down.
Corpse do on its day off? Turn the crank to find out. It was more so that the night watchman at the church could check to see if the person had genuinely returned to life or whether it was just a corpse moving. A lot of people think that this is what gave rise to the phrase saved by the bell, but Actually it was not. That is false. It's a boxing term.
Oh, saved by the bell. Right, yeah.
Versions of the safety coffin are even around today.
I bet.
Yeah. One of the most famous ones is one that was patented by an Italian guy in 1995. Cost about $5,000. It's equipped with a call for help ability and survival kit. So it had like a pager in it, because this is the 90s. Kind of like those alert devices that you get for old people when they like have a fall that they can wear around their necks and stuff. The coffin was also fitted with a two-way microphone/speaker to enable communication between the occupant and someone outside. And a little kit which included a torch, a small oxygen tank, a sensor to detect a person's heartbeat, and even a little defibrillator to stimulate the heart.
Are there not any that are, like, you know, Wi-Fi enabled? A little computer in there?
I did some extensive research on it, and I could not find any Wi-Fi enabled coffins. But
yeah,
I don't know how far underground you'd have to be for your iPhone to stop working. I think a lot of people are buried with their mobile phones, and actually it's often something that the officiant has to do at the funeral is to switch off the corpse's mobile phone.
That's so the last thing they have to do?
Before they start the service.
And then they switch it back on just before they put him in the ground.
Yeah, so that...
Can't remember the password and it's really awkward.
Well, just to make sure that no one calls them in the middle of the service I wonder what Bob's doing today. And then Crazy Frog plays through in the service and it's all really just horrible and emotional and awkward.
Well, you've got to lighten up a funeral somehow, haven't you?
So, I mean, if you were buried alive and you did have your iPhone or iPad, who would you call?
Write in and let us know.
Yeah, who would you
call? Hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. What would your death email be?
Yeah, who would
Guys,
you email?
We will quite honestly read
your
out the best.
Your premature burial email.
We'll read out the best death emails.
Oh, yeah, that'd be amazing.
A couple of episodes
the
line.
Who would you email and what would you say if you found out you were buried alive and you had your phone in your coffin? Please tell us, that's amazing. I have to think about that one, actually. I'll tell you guys mine next episode. Crazy coffins, all kinds of coffin contraptions. Safety coffins were an interesting invention in the 1700s and 1800s to avoid premature burial. And one of my other favourite inventions was the Leichenhauser.
The Leichenhauser?
Or the Totenhaus, which is what it was originally called.
Totenhaus, that's death something, isn't it?
Death house.
Death house.
Death house.
So, Leichenhauser.
That is otherwise known as a waiting mortuary, or a waiting house.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1788, an Austrian man called Johann Peter Frank originally patented the first Totenhaus. But the first one wasn't built until 1791, 3 years later.
Okay.
And they're basically...
Yeah, what are they?
Big houses full of wards, where you would just put the corpses on the bed.
Just sitting there waiting.
Just waiting to see if one of them woke up.
And presumably there had to be people wandering the halls, staring at corpses all day.
Yep. Corpses would be laid out in kind of like a halfway house. It was somewhere between a hospital mortuary and a tomb. And basically a sentinel would sit there.
Sentinel?
And just wait.
Good job title.
Yeah.
Not a great job, though.
The first one had 8 beds and an attendant who watched through a window through the door for signs of putrefaction. A fire was kept constantly alight in the kitchen. Hot water was used to heat the rooms so the corpses didn't get cold. And the heat wasn't just for the comfort of the potentially live inmates. It was also to speed up decomposition.
Yeah.
So people could see whether they were really dead. Between 1795 and 1828... these Leichenhauses were built all over Germany and started becoming more and more sophisticated. They used to have them separated by gender. So you'd have the man ward and the lady ward, as if to ensure some kind of propriety and privacy.
Uh-huh.
A bit weird.
Yep.
They even had one in Munich that would have separate sections for wealthy and poor cadavers. apparently that's still really important when you're dead. You have the poor corpse and the rich corpse.
Well, we don't want a wealthy merchant waking up from near death and being presented with the sight of a poor man.
There are a few later on that charged people, members of the public, a small fee to wander around and have a look.
Cool.
Yeah, so you could just like, oh, what should we do for our first date? I know, why not go visit a lichen house? Let's go, darling.
Let's look at some deads.
Yep, exactly. And they'd have big bouquets of fresh flowers to mask the scent of decay.
How long were they there for? Like the bodies, I mean, not the visitors.
The bodies were there until the signs of decay were evident. And the staff were supposed to clean the beds every hour. And there were even bells next to the beds so that someone could ring the bell if they woke up. But corpses would often shift and move and hit the bell and it would...
Oh, God.
Yep.
Imagine it.
Sometimes corpses kind of explode a little bit from the gases building up in the body. So the attendants had to clear that up too. The smell was really bad and they were expected to clean on an hourly basis, which is super gross.
I would think that they probably put that hourly basis thing in place just to stop the attendants getting bored and messing around with the bodies.
Yeah, and they weren't even allowed to leave for 5 minutes without express written permission from the director. They had to stay there.
Indoors?
Yep. In the hot, smelly, dead rooms. By the middle of the 1800s, popularity of these lichen houses had begun to wane, but people got really upset when they tried to close them down. Yeah. The last intact lichen house was still around in Germany in 1959, although it wasn't in use.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say.
They were still being built as late as 1875, though.
So, wait, when did you say the first one was built? 1791?
1791.
So for like 260 years?
About 100, yeah. I mean, they were still being built about 100 years later, and then they were kind of left to stand. And I think they basically fell out of fashion in the early 1900s. And this medicine and ability to figure out when someone was really genuinely dead got a bit more sophisticated. That's when the popularity of them started to wane.
Understandably. How many times, like during that, what, 210 odd years, how many people actually woke up in them?
Take a wild guess.
I'm going to hate myself for this, but I'm going to guess the number's a big old zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, none. None people ever woke up in those lichen houses. None people. It was just big buildings full of dead people, just everyone making sure that they weren't being buried alive. I mean, that to me is like...
That's an episode of human history.
That is an extreme collective manifestation of taphophobia. It's amazing. There you go. That is a pretty big history of mainly the fear of being buried alive. It's very, very unusual for people to actually be buried alive.
Do you have any documented, like, verified cases?
There are a few. I actually found a few of these on Snopes.com.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Snopes. If you type in buried alive on Snopes, you get some really, really interesting stories. So the claim is that Snopes is trying to disprove, or is fact-checking, is that people have been buried alive by mistake. And actually, a few people have, but it is so incredibly rare, and I really highly doubt that a lot of the ones in these people's books in the 1800s ever feature.
Of course.
A lot of these are much more recent. So a lot of them are more about like near misses, where people have actually been disinterred alive after they've been woken up. One of them in the late 16th century, a guy called Matthew Wall was being borne to his grave on the pallbearer's shoulders. And one of the pallbearers tripped and they dropped the coffin. And the guy sat up in the coffin. And apparently he lived on for several years and died in 1595. And every year he celebrated his resurrection.
Okay, so that's now made me a bit uneasy because... If it was just that one time that one guy tripped, the body turned out to be alive, how do we know that every time the pallbearers haven't tripped, which I would hope is quite often, the body was really dead?
Well, I mean...
2,700 is starting to sound like a pretty smart number to me.
I don't know about that. I mean, that's quite an unusual case, I think, of people being potentially like in a coma and needing a thump to wake up, or maybe I don't know.
I guess there's no way of knowing.
Yeah, there's really no way of knowing. There have been a couple in recent years. Mainly, a couple of people have woken up in mortuaries.
Okay, what, in the freezer drawers?
Yep.
Wow, cool.
There was a guy in Johannesburg who spent 2 days in a metal box in the mortuary before someone heard his cries and let him out after he had a motorcycle crash.
Wow, well, thank you for educating me on burying alive.
Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, you know, these days, getting accidentally buried alive is, like, close to impossible because the checks that have been put in place... And actually, this is something William Tebb introduced. This is the one great thing I think he did,
okay. Which
was before burial, he made it mandatory to get a doctor's certificate to ensure that the person was actually dead. So he basically invented the death certificate. Yeah. As we know it, the doctor's checks, making sure that someone is actually dead. So nowadays we do things like check for brain death, which is like we have, you know, heart monitors and MRI machines and, you know, things to test electrical activity in the brain and to really make sure that everything is done and gone. So that's burial alive.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to the first episode of our show. This has been really fun.
Yeah, I've really, really enjoyed telling you about all the weird, morbid things that we're really curious about. And I can't wait for next week's episode, next week's alphabet letters.
We have so much more to tell you. Next week's alphabet letters, if you don't know, are C and D. If you like what you've heard here, please find us on Facebook at...
www.facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1. That is the numeral one, not spelled O-N-E.
Or on Instagram at...
JimCrack Productions.
Or you can find us on Twitter at...
@JimCrackShows. Twitter is different, folks. And if you liked us, tell your friends.
Tell your friends
about us. Like we said, the first few episodes of a new podcast are absolutely crucial in... making sure we can keep doing this and more and more people find out all these cool, weird facts that we like to talk about. Yeah, we don't discriminate.
Jon Snow, he knows nothing. Until next time, Necronauts, I've been George Colley.
And I've been Rosie Cole. Stay morbid.
And stay curious.